Remember, the UN's two main bodies were the General Assembly, where every member nation had a seat, and the Security Council, which had five permanent members: the United States, the Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, and China, and six seats that rotated among other countries. Each of the permanent members could veto council actions, which meant it was impossible for the UN to do anything that any one of the top powers didn't like. While the United Nations did have some success in international cooperation when it came to subjects like health and education, it could do little to slow down the nuclear arms race or prevent the superpowers from interfering in other countries. The world as a chessboard. The first big test of wills between the United States and the Soviet Union came in the Mediterranean. Communist-backed rebels in Greece and Turkey were trying to overthrow the governments in those two countries. Britain had been assisting the Greek and Turkish governments, but was in deep economic trouble at home and couldn't continue. So, Harry Truman went to Congress. Truman was a former U.S. senator from Missouri who had been made vice president in 1944 and succeeded Franklin Roosevelt as president when Roosevelt died in 1945. Truman was blunt, honest, and outspoken. He often complained about what a tough job it was to be president. But most of the time, he wasn't shy about doing it, and to hell with anyone who didn't like the way he did it. Remember, in March 1947, Truman asked Congress for $400 million to help the Greek and Turkish governments. He also asked to send U.S. military advisors to both countries, at their request. In what became known as the Truman Doctrine, Truman drew a sharp distinction between the communist way of life and the free world. Congress went along, sending more than $600 million to the two countries by 1950. Truman's doctrine was part of an overall strategy to contain communism. The idea was to make other countries prosperous enough that they wouldn't be tempted to go red. Other elements of the containment strategy included the Marshall Plan, named after General George C. Marshall, who became Truman's Secretary of State. The plan provided about $12 billion in U.S. aid to 16 countries in Western Europe to help them recover from the ravages of the war. The plan was a rousing success, and by 1952, much of Western Europe was well on its way to economic recovery. NATO. In 1949, the United States and 11 Western nations formed the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The countries agreed to come to the aid of any member nation that was attacked and to develop an international security force that would help discourage aggression by non-NATO countries. The Four-Point Program. This was sort of a junior Marshall Plan. Proposed by Truman in 1949, it provided about $400 million to undeveloped countries in Asia, Latin America, and Africa for developing industry, communications, and technological systems. The Berlin Airlift. The Soviet Union didn't watch all this U.S. activity while lazing in a hammock. After the war, temporary governance of Germany had been divided among France, Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union. The city of Berlin was deep in the Soviet sector, but run by all four nations. So when the Soviets became irritated at all the containment in 1948, they blockaded Berlin, hoping to force the Western countries out of the city completely. Remember, instead, the Western countries mounted a huge airlift, shipping food and other supplies over the blockade and into the city. In May 1949, the Soviets lifted the blockade. But the tensions made both sides realize that there would be no easy solution to reestablishing a new Germany. So the Western powers agreed to create one country out of their half, and the Soviets created another country out of the other half. East Germany and West Germany would not be united again for more than 40 years. Big Red in the Corn. One reason behind the distrust between the United States and the Soviet Union was that the countries didn't really know each other very well. So it was big news in 1959 when leaders of the two countries exchanged visits. In July, Vice President Richard Nixon went to Moscow to attend an exhibit of American products, including a six-room ranch-style model home. Nixon and Soviet Chairman Nikita Khrushchev got into a heated and televised quarrel over the relative merits of each country's economic system. In September, Khrushchev came to America. Among his stops were Hollywood, San Francisco, Franklin Roosevelt's grave, and Coon Rapids, Iowa. It seems the chairman had been invited to visit the farm of a fellow named Roswell Garst, who had been selling corn seed to the Soviet Union since 1955 and fancied himself a bit of a diplomat as well as a farmer. After a tour of Garst's farm, Khrushchev offered what could have been a summary of his whole trip. Garst, the chairman said, was a class enemy, but was generously willing to trade secrets with others, even us. The Miracle of 48. Despite some success overseas, Truman was considered a political dead duck as the 1948 elections drew near. The Republicans had gained seats in Congress in 1946. Truman's former Secretary of Commerce, Henry Wallace, had decided to run as a liberal third-party candidate, sure to take votes from Truman. Segregationist Strom Thurmond, governor of South Carolina, also decided to run as an independent candidate. The Republicans were running Governor Thomas Dewey of New York, a man who was considered solid, if a bit dull. Someone suggested he looked like the little plastic guy on wedding cakes. But true to form, Truman decided to give him hell. He stumped around the country, ragging on the Republican-controlled Congress as a bunch of do-nothings and pledging to change things at home and abroad if given another term. When the votes were counted, Truman had pulled off the biggest upset in presidential political history, and the Democrats had taken back Congress. Their reward was another war. The Korean War. The Cold War was at its hottest in Korea. After World War II ended, the Russians controlled the northern part of the country and the United States the south. In 1949, the Soviets left a communist government in charge in the north, and the United States left a pro-Western government in the south. China, meanwhile, finished its civil war and was now firmly in the control of communists. On June 24, 1950, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. A few days later, Truman ordered U.S. troops to the aid of South Korea and convinced the U.N. to send military aid as well, in what was referred to in diplomatic circles as a police action. The U.N. troops, which were mostly American, were under the command of U.S. General Douglas MacArthur. Because the North Korean attack was such a surprise, the U.S. and South Korean forces were pushed into the far southern corner of the Korean Peninsula by September. But MacArthur pulled off a risky but brilliant amphibious landing behind the North Koreans. By November, he had driven the enemy deep into North Korea and was poised to push them into China. Then the Chinese army poured troops into the fight and forced the U.N. troops back into South Korea. The U.N. forces reorganized and counterattacked, forcing the Chinese back behind the 38th parallel of latitude, where the war had started in the first place. For the next 18 months, an uneasy truce, sporadically interrupted by skirmishing, was in place. Finally, in July 1953, an agreement to call the whole mess a draw was reached. The Korean War cost more than $50 billion and 33,000 U.S. lives. Another 110,000 or so were wounded. It also cost Truman politically. when MacArthur publicly disagreed with Truman over Truman's decision not to invade China, the general was fired. MacArthur returned to a hero's welcome in America, and Truman was unfairly pilloried as being soft on communism. Remember, Truman didn't run for re-election in 1952. Instead, the country turned to its most popular military figure in decades, Dwight David Eisenhower. Ike was so apolitical, he didn't even decide which political party to join until shortly before accepting the Republican nomination. As supreme Allied commander in Europe, Eisenhower had been a bold and decisive military leader during World War II. But as president, his approach, at least on domestic issues, was to move cautiously, if at all. He does deserve credit for investing in and jump-starting America's interstate highway system, but only reluctantly involved the federal government in the struggle for civil rights. Dominoes. You have a row of dominoes set up, and you knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is the certainty that it will go over very quickly. President Eisenhower, explaining why the United States needed to stop the communists in Vietnam, April 7, 1954. Uncle Sam's Big Stick. One thing Eisenhower's administration wasn't shy about was injecting itself into other countries' internal affairs. In 1953, Central Intelligence Agency, CIA operatives, helped topple a communist-influenced government in Iran and reinstate the dictatorial Shah. The following year, the CIA aided a coup in Guatemala, ousting a communist-backed but constitutionally elected leader and replacing him with a U.S.-friendly president. Remember, it wasn't only ideology that motivated America. In Iran, the United States made sure Iranian oil was kept flowing toward America and not the Soviet Union. In Guatemala, the interests of American fruit companies were being protected. In Asia, the United States was busy providing aid to France to help it fight a communist rebellion in its colony of Vietnam. By 1954, the French had lost the northern half of the country, and by 1956, the United States was steadily increasing the amount of aid it was sending to South Vietnam. Finding commies under the bed. Not all the world's communists were in other countries. Since the 1920s, there had been a communist party in the United States that had taken orders from party leaders in the Soviet Union. But the average American didn't pay much attention. After World War II, however, communist became a much dirtier word. U.S. government officials helped fuel the fire by talking almost daily about spies and the dangers of communists and communist sympathizers. Remember, part of the reason for the anti-communist fears was that communists ran America's biggest post-war rivals, the Soviet Union and China. Part was bewilderment over the success the communists were having in Asia and Eastern Europe. And part was there really were some spies, and the U.S. government failed to keep the atomic bomb the exclusive property of America. Whatever the reason, commie hunting became a national pastime. In 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, dominated by Republicans who included a freshman member from California named Richard M. Nixon, began searching for communists within and without government. One place they looked was Hollywood. Actors, directors, and writers were called before the committee, and 10 who refused to testify were jailed. Others were blacklisted and couldn't get jobs in the industry for years afterward. But no great plot to undermine America through the movies was ever uncovered. Casting suspicion on Hiss. The committee caught a bigger fish in 1948. Whitaker Chambers, a Time magazine editor who said he had been a communist until 1937, told the committee that a former member of Roosevelt's State Department, Alger Hiss, had passed information to Soviet spies. Hiss denied the charges, even after Chambers produced, from a hollowed-out pumpkin, what he said was microfilm passed between the men. Neither could be prosecuted for espionage because too much time had passed. But Hiss was found guilty of perjury and sentenced to 5 years in prison. The Hiss conviction helped Nixon get elected to the Senate in 1950 and win a place as Eisenhower's running mate in 1952. Helen Gehagen Douglas. Helen Gehagen Douglas was the Pink Lady of American politics. Douglas was born in New Jersey in 1900. She left college in 1922 to become an opera singer and a leading Broadway actress. With her husband, actor Melvin Douglas, Helen moved to California and became active in Democratic politics. After working to better the plight of migrant farm workers, she won a seat in Congress in 1944, representing a heavily African-American district in Los Angeles. In 1950, Helen ran for the U.S. Senate against another member of Congress, Richard Nixon. Nixon had won a national reputation as a communist hunter and wasted little time implying that Helen was, if not an outright commie, pink right down to her underwear. Helen's liberalism did not play well with voters, especially after the Korean War broke out and Nixon easily defeated her. She left politics, became an author, and died in 1980. As part of her legacy, she left behind a nickname she gave Nixon that stuck with him all the way to the White House, Tricky Dick. Leaking Scientific Secrets, the Rosenbergs. Hiss wasn't the only trophy for the commie hunters. In February 1950, it was revealed that a British scientist had given atomic secrets to the Soviets. Among his allies, it was announced, were a New York couple named Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. The Rosenbergs were charged with getting information from Ethel's brother, who worked on the U.S. bomb project in New Mexico. They were convicted of treason and executed in 1953. Checking the loyalty of federal workers. Despite some reservations that things were getting out of hand, President Truman didn't leave all the ferreting out of communists to Congress. In 1947, Truman ordered a government-wide loyalty review. By the time it was done, more than 3 million federal workers had been reviewed. More than 2,000 workers resigned, and about 200 were fired. Not to be outdone, Congress passed bills in 1950 and 1952, over Truman's vetoes, that made it illegal to do anything that would substantially contribute to the establishment of a totalitarian dictatorship. The bills also required communist front organizations to register with the Justice Department and denied admission to the country to aliens who had been members of totalitarian groups, even as children. A shot at polio. Every summer, polio showed up. A crippling disease that most often struck children and left them paralyzed or dead. In 1952 alone, more than 21,000 U.S. children were infected. Jonas Salk wanted to do something about the poliomyelitis virus. Salk, a University of Pittsburgh Medical School researcher, worked for almost 8 years to develop a vaccine. Finally, after exhaustive trials, the government licensed the vaccine on April 12, 1955. Salk refused to become rich by patenting the vaccine and hoped the federal government would take over its distribution. The Eisenhower administration greeted the idea icily. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Ovita Culp-Hobby, called it socialized medicine by the back door. But Salk's vaccine, delivered via injections, eventually was distributed free by the government and saved thousands of children from the disease. In 1961, an oral vaccine developed by Dr. Albert Sabin was licensed and administered around the world. polio is now virtually unknown in the United States. By 2017, there were only 22 cases of polio reported in the entire world. Shut up, Senator. Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You have done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you no sense of decency? Army Counsel Joseph Welch to Senator Joseph McCarthy during hearings on suspected communists in the U.S. Army, June 9, 1954. Telling Tall Tales, Tail Gunner Joe. He was a liar and a drunk, and for a few years, he was one of the most powerful men in America. In February 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin gave a speech in West Virginia. In the speech, McCarthy said he had a list of 205 known communists working in the State Department. It was nonsense, but it made national headlines, and McCarthy repeated it and similar charges over the next 4 years. Remember, McCarthy, who claimed to have been a tail gunner who saw lots of action during World War II, actually had never seen any combat. But he was a formidable opponent in the commie hunting field. He ripped even General George Marshall and President Eisenhower. Every time he made a charge that proved to be untrue, McCarthy simply made up a new charge. The tactic became known as McCarthyism. By the summer of 1954, however, McCarthy's antics were wearing thin. When he began a series of attacks on the Army for coddling communists during congressional hearings, they were televised. Many Americans got their first look at McCarthy in action and were repulsed. In December 1954, the Senate censured him. He died in obscurity 3 years later of problems related to alcoholism. Having it all. After World War II, the American economy hummed along. There were plenty of jobs for returning servicemen. There was also the GI Bill of Rights, which passed Congress in 1944 and provided veterans more than $13 billion in the decade after the war for college tuition, vocational training programs, or money to start a business. Perhaps most important, the bill offered vets no money down, low-interest loans to buy homes. A booming economy. Thanks to a $6 billion tax cut and all the savings from buying bonds during the war, Americans had plenty to spend. The high consumer demand for goods triggered high inflation, 14 to 15% for the first 2 years after the war for goods in general, and a painful 25% for food. Such high costs, in turn, triggered a lot of labor unrest, with 5,000 strikes in 1946 alone, and major troubles in the coal and rail industries. President Truman reinstated wartime price controls to deal with inflation, and the Republican Congress passed a bill called the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947 that restricted labor union power. By 1949, the economy had adjusted to the ending of the war, and the country entered an almost unprecedented economic boom. From 1945 to 1960, the gross national product, the value of the amount of goods and services produced, increased from $200 billion to $500 billion per year. Thousands of smaller companies merged or were gobbled up by large corporations. So were many family farms by large company farms. Remember, the economy wasn't the only thing growing. The birth rate boomed as men and women pushed apart by the war made up for lost time. The population grew 20% in the 1950s, from 150 million to 180 million, and the generation born between 1946 and 1964 became known as the baby boomers. Along with the economy and the population, Americans' appetite for the good life, the number of private cars purchased doubled in the 1950s, and the perceived need to keep up with the Joneses also grew. Moving to the burbs. Having your own car meant you could live farther away from where you worked. The suburbs grew 47% in the 1950s as more and more Americans staked out their own little territory. New housing starts, which had dropped to 100,000 a year during the war, climbed to 1.5 million annually. To fill the need, home builders turned to assembly line techniques. The leading pioneer was a New York developer named William J. Levitt. A former member of the Navy construction battalion known as the Seabees, Levitt knew how to build things in a hurry. He bought 1,500 acres on Long Island and on March 7, 1949, opened a sales office with more than 1,000 customers already waiting. A basic Levitt four-room house on a 6,000-square-foot lot sold for $6,900, about 2.5 years' wages. The cookie-cutter approach in Island Trees, later changed to Levittown, was criticized as stifling individuality. But to the 82,000 people living in 17,000 new houses, it was home. Other builders followed suit all over the country, and 13 million new homes were sold during the decade. No man who owns his own house and a lot can be a communist, Levitt said. He has too much to do. Of course, his sentiments didn't extend to African Americans. They were excluded from buying homes at his developments for fear they would scare away white buyers. The Golden Age of Greece. Brothers Richard and Maurice MacDonald were bored with the drive-in barbecue joint they had opened in 1940 in San Bernardino, California, and they were tired of all the teens who hung around the place after they ate as if it were a clubhouse. So in 1948, the MacDonalds fired their car hops, cut their menu to 9 items, dropped the price of a hamburger from 30 cents to 15 cents, replaced tableware with paper bags and cups, and pre-assembled much of the food. The fast food was perfect for the speeded-up post-war society. A Chicago milkshake machine salesman named Ray Kroc loved the idea. Kroc convinced the McDonald's brothers to make him their franchising agent and then bought the brothers out in 1961. By the time Kroc died in 1984, there were 7,500 McDonald's outlets. Today, there are nearly 37,000, serving 69 million people a day in 120 countries. And why did Kroc stick with the brothers' name even after he bought them out? Because, he once explained, no one was going to buy a Kroc burger, or a Big Kroc, for that matter. Tuning into the tube. There was less discrimination when it came to selling consumer products, and one of the most popular products in the 1950s was the TV. At the start of the decade, there were about 3 million TV owners. By the end of it, there were 55 million, watching shows from 530 stations. The average price of TV sets dropped from about $500 in 1949 to $200 in 1953. Remember, like radio before it, the spread of TV had a huge cultural impact. Beginning with the 1948 campaign, it made itself felt in U.S. politics. One wonderful effect was that it made speeches shorter. Politicians and commentators alike began to think and speak in sound bites that fit the medium. By 1960, the televised debates between candidates Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy were considered a crucial element in Kennedy's narrow victory. TV also helped make professional and college sports big businesses, and sometimes provided excellent comedy and dramatic shows to vast audiences that might not otherwise have had access to them. But even to its mildest critics, much of what was on the often aptly nicknamed boob tube was mindless junk. It was designed to sell products. It homogenized cultural tastes to the point of blandness, and it created feelings of inadequacy in some, who felt their real lives should compare with the insipidly happy characters they saw on shows like Leave It to Beaver. Federal Communications Commission, FCC Chairman Newton Minow called it a vast wasteland. Nonetheless, it was a popular wasteland. Comedian Milton Berle's show was so loved, for example, that movie theaters in some towns closed down Tuesday nights because everyone was home watching Uncle Milty. And in 1954, the Toledo, Ohio Water Commissioner reported that water consumption surged at certain times because so many people were simultaneously using their toilets during commercial breaks on the most popular shows. Rockin' and Rollin'. America had 13 million teenagers by the mid-1950s, and they had a lot of money to spend, an average of about $10 a week. One of the things they spent it on was their own music. It was a mix of blues and country that was as much about youthful rebellion as it was the sound, and it was called rock and roll, a term coined in 1952 by a Cleveland radio personality named Alan Freed, who became the new sound's Pied Piper. Adult backlash was fierce. Ministers decried it as satanic. Racists called it jungle music, and law enforcement officials deemed it riot-inciting. Most troubling to some older Americans was that the music tended to blur racial divides among young people. You couldn't easily segregate the radio dial. Of course, the more adults squawked about it, surprise, the more kids wanted it. In 1954, Shake, Rattle, and Roll by Bill Haley and the Comets sold more than 1 million records. Scores of rock stars came and went almost overnight. Others, such as Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard, were stars with more staying power. What a doll! Ruth Handler went shopping in Switzerland in the 1950s and found retail gold. Handler, with her husband Elliot and his business partner Harold Mattson, had started a toy company in 1945 that they named by combining Mattson's name and Elliot's to form Mattel. Anyway, Ruth Handler bought a German-made doll named Lily while on her Swiss shopping spree. Unlike most American dolls, which were modeled after babies, Lily was modeled after babes, as in buxom, long-legged young women. Handler had seen her own daughter playing with similar-looking paper dolls and figured a U.S. version of Lily might catch on. So in 1959, Mattel introduced a very grown-up-looking doll with an impressive wardrobe, which of course was sold separately. It was a hit, and the company sold $500 million worth of dolls and related products in the first decade after its introduction. The line has added heaps of supporting characters ever since, but the original mainstays have remained Barbie and Ken, named after the Handler's own son and daughter. Doll collectors the world over are glad the Handlers didn't name their kids Attila and Hortense. An American King. Remember, and then there was Elvis. Born in Mississippi in 1935 and raised in Tennessee by poor working-class parents, Elvis Presley became perhaps the most recognized personality in the world during the decade. In 1956 alone, he was selling $75,000 worth of records per day and had signed a three-picture movie deal. A staggering 54 million people tuned in to see him on the Ed Sullivan TV show. By the time he died in 1977, Presley was the undisputed king of rock and roll, and composer Leonard Bernstein had referred to him as the greatest cultural force in the 20th century. One effect of the new music was to open up new audiences for African-American performers. Chuck Berry became the first black rock star to have a hit on the mainstream charts. More than 90 years after the end of slavery, music was one of the new fields open to African-Americans. Buddy Holly. his career lasted only 18 months, but his influence on American music has lasted more than half a century. Charles Hardin Holley was born in Lubbock, Texas, in 1936. After high school, Holley played in a trio, focusing on country music. But his heart was in the new sounds of rock and roll. In May 1957, Holley, his name had been spelled wrong on a record label, and he just went along with it, and his group, the Crickets, released their first hit, "That'll Be the Day." By the end of the year, Holley had 3 million sellers, and by the end of 1958, he had sold 10 million records. Unlike other teen stars, Holley not only played guitar and sang, but also wrote, arranged, and produced most of his music, and experimented with techniques such as double tracking. He was also one of the first U.S. rock stars to tour abroad. But on February 3, 1959, his career came to a sudden end. After a concert in Clear Lake, Iowa, the 22-year-old Holley and three others were killed when their small plane crashed. The tragedy was immortalized in the 1972 song American Pie as "The Day the Music Died." Holley's musical influence lived on not only in America, but overseas as well. A fledgling rock group in Liverpool, England, for instance, named itself a variation of Holley's group, the Crickets. They called themselves the Beatles. Moving slowly to the front of the bus. By the 1950s, after fighting through two world wars and struggling through the Depression, many African Americans were fed up with their glacial-paced progress in achieving equality. The result was a series of events that added up to the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. Brown against the Board. On May 17, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court issued one of its most important decisions. In a case called Brown v. the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, justices unanimously ruled that the segregation of public schools was unconstitutional. Brown overturned an 1896 Supreme Court decision that had said schools could be segregated if the facilities that were offered different groups were equal, which, of course, they seldom, if ever, were. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place, wrote Chief Justice Earl Warren. The court followed its decision a year later with broad rules for desegregating America's schools, but they included no timetable. Some communities moved quickly, but others, mostly in the South, made it clear they were in no hurry to comply with the court's ruling. By 1957, only about 20% of Southern school districts had even begun the process. Remember, in September 1957, a federal court ordered Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, desegregated. A white mob decided to block the admission of 9 black students, and Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus refused to do anything about it. So a reluctant President Eisenhower sent in 1,000 federal troops and activated 10,000 members of the National Guard to protect the students and escort them to class. In the same month, Congress passed a bill that authorized the Attorney General to stop Southern elected officials from interfering with African Americans registering to vote, established a Federal Civil Rights Commission, created a Civil Rights Enforcement Division within the U.S. Justice Department. The sad fact, however, was that in many places in the South, the laws went largely unenforced. Fair ball. Branch Rickey needed an African-American who was smart, had the ability to play baseball at the major league level, and could keep his mouth shut under trying circumstances. Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, thought he had found him in John Roosevelt Robinson. Known to his friends as Jackie, Robinson was a 28-year-old UCLA graduate and former Army officer whom Rickey had signed to play for Montreal in the minor leagues in 1945. Robinson was irritated when Ricky kept telling him about all the virulent hatred he would face as the first African-American player in the major leagues. "Mr. Ricky, do you want a ball player who's afraid to fight back?" Robinson asked. Ricky replied, "I want a player with guts enough not to fight back." On April 15, 1947, Robinson stepped to the plate for the first time in a major league game. By the end of the year, he was the National League's best rookie, and 2 years later, its most valuable player. Robinson opened the gates for thousands of African Americans in professional sports and inspired millions of Americans of all races with his dignity, courage, and refusal to lose. Boycotting the bus. Like a rock dropped in a still pond, the Supreme Court decision on school desegregation started ripples of change throughout the country. One of them hit Montgomery, Alabama, on December 1, 1955. A 42-year-old African-American woman named Rosa Parks was tired after a long day working, and she was tired of being treated as a second-class human being. So Parks refused to get up from her seat on the bus when the driver demanded she give it to a white man. That was against the law, and Parks was arrested. Her arrest sparked a boycott of the bus system by the black community. Facing the highly damaging boycott and a 1956 Supreme Court decision that declared segregation on public transportation unconstitutional, the Montgomery Bus Company dropped its race-based seating plan in 1957. More important than getting to ride in the front of the bus was the example the boycott set as to how effective organized demonstration against segregation could be. Equally important was the emergence on the national scene of the boycott's leader, an eloquent, charismatic son of a well-known Atlanta minister who admired the nonviolent protest philosophies of India's Mohandas Gandhi. His name was Martin Luther King, Jr., and he was to become one of the most important men in America in the coming decade. But what? Frankly, it didn't look like much. A little blip of a light in the evening sky that appeared to be moving much slower than its 18,000 miles per hour. But to Americans watching on October 5, 1957, the blip represented a terrible thought. The commies might someday rule the world from outer space. That's because the little blip was a Soviet satellite called Sputnik, Russian for fellow traveler. It was the first such object, and within a few weeks, it was followed by Sputnik 2. Americans were shocked. Fears of superweapons orbiting above the United States competed with the feeling that a new day was dawning for humanity. During the next year, the United States launched 4 satellites of its own, and within 2 years, U.S. efforts to catch up with the Soviet Union in space were in full gear. The space race had joined the arms race in the political Olympics between the superpowers. Chapter 18. Camelot to Watergate, 1961 to 1974. In this chapter, electing and losing JFK, entering the war in Vietnam, trying to put an end to discrimination, forming a counterculture in protest, impeaching Nixon. The decade of the 1960s began with a defeat for Richard Nixon and ended in victory for him. In between, America became mired in a war it never understood and saw its citizens take to the streets in the name of peace, justice, and racial rage. By the mid-1970s, U.S. streets were clearing. Nixon had suffered the last and worst defeat of his career, and America was trying to figure out just what the heck had happened in the preceding 14 years. Electing an icon. He was rich, handsome, witty, and married to a beautiful woman, and he looked good on the increasingly important medium of television. His opponent was middle class, jowly, whiny, and married to a less beautiful woman, and on TV, he looked like 50 miles of bad road. Even so, Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy won the presidency in 1960 over Vice President Richard Nixon by a very narrow margin, and only, some said, because his father, bootlegger-turned-tycoon Joseph Kennedy, had rigged the results in Illinois and Texas. After 8 years of the fatherly but colorless Dwight Eisenhower, Jack and Jacqueline Kennedy excited the interest of the country. Kennedy, known to headline writers as JFK, gave off an aura of youth, vigor, and shiny virtue. In truth, however, he was plagued with health problems, from excruciatingly painful osteoporosis to venereal disease. He popped pain pills and took amphetamine injections, was an insatiable womanizer, and didn't mind bending the truth from time to time. After his death, his widow coined the term Camelot, after the mythical realm of King Arthur and his knights, to describe JFK's quest to lead America and the rest of the world to a brighter future. Kennedy himself called on Americans to push toward a new frontier of challenges, such as landing a man on the moon by the end of the decade. But his first big challenge came very soon after he took office, and much closer to home. Call for volunteers. Let the word go forth from this time and place, to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. John F. Kennedy, Inaugural Address, January 20th, 1961. The Bay of Pigs. Cuba had been a thorn in the United States' side since 1959, when dictator Fulgencio Batista was overthrown by Fidel Castro, an aspiring baseball player turned communist firebrand. Castro soon became an ardent anti-American, ordering the takeover of U.S.-owned businesses in Cuba and establishing close ties with the Soviet Union. Kennedy gave his approval to a scheme that centered on anti-Castro Cuban exiles being trained by the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, for an invasion of the island. The idea was that the Cuban people would rally to the invader's side and oust Castro. The invasion took place April 17, 1961, at the Bay of Pigs on Cuba's southern coast. It was a disaster. No one rushed to their side, and many of the invaders were captured and held for 2 years before being ransomed by the U.S. government. Remember, the resulting embarrassment to America encouraged the Soviet Union to increase pressure in Europe by erecting a wall dividing East and West Berlin and resuming the testing of nuclear weapons. Kennedy, meanwhile, tried to counter the Soviet move by renewing U.S. weapons testing, increasing foreign aid to third world nations, and establishing the Peace Corps to export U.S. ideals as well as technical aid. The Soviets weren't impressed, and tensions between the two superpowers escalated. Facing the possibility of nuclear war. During the summer of 1962, the Soviets began developing nuclear missile sites in Cuba. That meant they could easily strike targets over much of North and South America. When air reconnaissance photos confirmed the site's presence on October 14th, JFK had to make a tough choice. Destroy the sites and quite possibly trigger World War III, or do nothing and not only expose the country to nuclear destruction, but, in effect, concede first place in the world domination race to the USSR. Kennedy decided to get tough. On October 22, 1962, he went on national television and announced the U.S. Navy would throw a blockade around Cuba and turn away any ships carrying materials that could be used at the missile sites. He also demanded the sites be dismantled. Then the world waited for the Russian reaction. On October 26th, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev sent a message suggesting the missiles would be removed if the United States promised not to invade Cuba and eventually removed some U.S. missile sites from Turkey. The crisis, perhaps the closest the world came to nuclear conflict during the Cold War, was over, and the payoffs were ample. A hotline was installed between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union to help defuse future confrontations. And in July 1963, all the major countries except China and France agreed to stop above-ground testing of nuclear weapons. A dark day in Dallas. Even with his success in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy admitted he was generally frustrated by his first 1,000 days in office. Despite considerable public popularity, many of JFK's social and civil rights programs had made little progress in a Democrat-controlled but conservative Congress. Still, Kennedy was looking forward to running for a second term in 1964, and on November 22, 1963, he went to Texas to improve his political standing in that state. While riding in an open car in a motorcade in Dallas, Kennedy was shot and killed by a sniper. A former Marine and one-time Soviet Union resident named Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for the crime. 2 days later, a national television audience watched in disbelief as Oswald himself was shot and killed by a Dallas nightclub owner named Jack Ruby, while Oswald was being moved to a different jail. Whether Oswald and Ruby acted alone or were part of conspiracies has been debated for decades. America was stunned. The age of Camelot was over. And a veteran politician from Texas named Lyndon B. Johnson was president of the United States. Advocating for birds, Rachel Carson. Because a friend of hers noticed some birds dying, Rachel Carson saved millions more. Carson was born in Pennsylvania in 1907. She earned a zoology degree from Johns Hopkins University, and after teaching a while, went to work for the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries. In 1951, her second book, The Sea Around Us, became a bestseller, allowing Carson to devote herself to writing full-time. One day, Carson got a letter from a friend in Massachusetts who had a small bird sanctuary. The friend had noticed that a lot of birds had died after the area was sprayed with the insecticide DDT to kill mosquitoes. Carson decided to investigate. The result, in 1962, was Silent Spring, a carefully researched and eloquently written indictment of the pesticide's impact on the reproductive functions of fish and birds. The book started an avalanche of controversy around DDT. Finally, in 1972, the Nixon administration ordered a ban on the substance. Carson didn't live to see the ban. She died of cancer in 1964 at the age of 57. But her landmark work is considered by many to be the start of the modern environmental movement in America. Sending troops to Vietnam. If John F. Kennedy represented a fresh new face in the White House, his successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was a classic example of the old school of U.S. politics. A Texan, LBJ had served in both houses of Congress for more than 20 years before being elected as JFK's vice president in 1960, and was considered one of the most effective Senate leaders in history. As president, Johnson inherited a host of problems, not the least of which was a growing mess in Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam. Before World War II, Vietnam had been a French colony, and after the Japanese were defeated and driven out, it reverted to French control. But despite U.S. monetary aid, France was driven out of the country in 1954 by communist forces led by the French-educated Ho Chi Minh. The country was divided in two, with the communists controlling the northern half. Elections were scheduled for 1956 to reunite the two halves. But they never took place, mostly because South Vietnam dictator Ngo Dinh Diem was afraid he would lose. The U.S. supported Diem, at least until 1963, when he became so unpopular he was assassinated with the U.S. government's unofficial blessing. At first, the support amounted to financial aid. Then U.S. military advisors, who were not directly engaged in combat, were sent in. But the pressure to do more mounted as the fighting dragged on, and by the time of Kennedy's assassination, 16,000 advisors had been sent to Vietnam. Sinking deeper into a confusing war. Shortly after taking office, Johnson ordered 5,000 more troops to Vietnam and planned to send another 5,000. In August 1964, he announced that U.S. Navy ships had been attacked in international waters near the Gulf of Tonkin. Congress reacted by overwhelmingly approving a resolution that gave Johnson the power to take all necessary measures to protect U.S. forces. A few months later, LBJ ordered bombings of targets in North Vietnam. By March 1965, more than 100,000 U.S. troops were in the country. Within 3 years, that number had swelled to more than 500,000. It was a lot of people to fight a war no one seemed to understand how to win. America had overwhelming military superiority, but it was mostly designed to fight a conventional war with big battles and conquered territories. Remember, Vietnam was different. It was essentially a civil war, which meant it was often tough to figure out who was on whose side. The communists in the South were called the Viet Cong. They were aided by North Vietnamese Army troops, referred to as the NVA. The dense jungle terrain made it difficult to locate and fight large concentrations of the enemy. There were conflicts between U.S. political leaders who wanted to contain the war and military leaders who wanted to expand it. Finally, the lack of clear objectives and declining public support demoralized many American soldiers. Taking a look at the Tet Offensive. On January 31, 1968, the Vietnamese New Year, called Tet, communist forces unleashed massive attacks on U.S. positions throughout Vietnam. The Tet Offensive, televised nightly in the United States, shocked many Americans who had the idea that the United States was rather easily handling the enemy. In fact, U.S. forces eventually pushed the North Vietnamese forces back and inflicted huge casualties on them. But the impact the fighting had on U.S. public opinion was equally huge. Opposition to the war grew more heated and contributed mightily to LBJ's decision not to run for re-election in 1968. Muhammad Ali. He was the most famous sports figure in the world, perhaps the most famous person, period. If you didn't believe it, all you had to do was ask him. "I am," he would reply, "the greatest." Ali was born Cassius Clay in Louisville, Kentucky, in 1942. After winning a gold medal at the 1960 Olympics, he turned pro. In 1964, Clay won the heavyweight championship and successfully defended it 9 times over the next 3 years. Witty, charming, and arrogant, he was resented and disliked by many white Americans for not being humble enough. He became even more controversial when he became a black Muslim and changed his name. Then, in 1967, he was stripped of his title and sentenced to 5 years in prison for refusing to be drafted into the military on grounds of his religious beliefs. The Supreme Court eventually reversed the conviction, and Ali won the title back in 1974 from George Foreman, defending it 10 more times before losing it in 1978 to Leon Spinks, and then winning it for a third time in a rematch with Spinks later that year. Ali announced his retirement from the ring in 1979, although he returned for 2 losing matches in 1980. The onset of Parkinson's disease made it difficult for him to speak in his later years, but he managed an electrifying appearance as a torchbearer at the 1996 Olympics. Ali died in 2016, still the greatest in the minds of many boxing fans. Increasing pressure in Nam